Welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. I am your host, Chris Panaski. This podcast was created so as to share the stories of bike tours, bike packers, and endurance racers from around the world as they embark on amazing adventures. Through their stories, you'll be able to learn the ins and outs of bike travel. You'll get insight into various countries and cultures, hear fantastic stories of their journeys, and through both mine and my guests' experiences, you'll learn about the pros and cons of specific gear, bikes, and bike setups. If you're new to bike travel and considering going on an adventure, I hope the podcast provides you with that extra little bit of motivation to make it happen. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is proudly supported by Panorama Cycles, Redshift Sports, Tailfin Bikepacking Equipment, Race Day Fuel, and Full Cycle Ottawa. Their continued support allows me to focus my efforts on providing you amazing content. Now back to the show. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is supported by some pretty rad companies. A couple of them are Panorama Cycles and Full Cycle Ottawa. The new Panorama Katadin 2.1 is a gravel rig tuned for long-haul comfort and wild terrain. Built with lighter tubing and progressive geometry, the frame has also been tested to full mountain bike standards for durability and peace of mind, even when the trail disappears and the terrain gets rowdy. With integrated mounts, generous tire clearance, and reliability-first components, it's the bike packer's dream machine. Roll deeper, explore wilder, ride the Katadin 2.1. On gravel roads or cruising through city streets, Full Cycle Ottawa has been your trusted ride companion for over 30 years. Locally rooted and rider-approved, they stock top-tier bikes from legendary brands like Norco, Cannondale, Cervelo, and distribute Panorama Cycles. From expert service to cutting-edge gear, Full Cycle keeps your wheels turning. Ready to roll? Swing by today. Your next adventure starts at Full Cycle Ottawa. This episode of the Bikepack Adventures Podcast, I sit down once again with ultra-endurance athlete and rider Megan Hakkinen. Fresh off her incredible performance at the 2025 Silk Road Mountain Race, over 1,954 kilometers and 28,000 meters of climbing through the rugged terrain of Kyrgyzstan, Megan not only finished the race, she crushed it, claiming first place in the women's category and 10th overall with a time of 9 days, 4 hours, and 6 minutes. This conversation dives deep into the final chapter of her year-long quest to complete the mountain race series, which included the Atlas Mountain Race, the Hellenic Mountain Race, and now the Silk Road. We explore the grit, gear, and mindset it takes to thrive in some of the world's harshest conditions, from her bike setup and tire choices to sleep strategies and mental resilience. Whether you're a seasoned racer or curious adventurer, or someone who just loves a good story of perseverance, this episode is a must listen. So grab a drink and let's roll into Megan's journey across the mountains. Megan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have made it this far and got to, you know, be invited back for the third episode. That means I finished.
Yeah. And you know what? If we don't talk about all those things I just put in the intro, we got a big problem. This is your sixth time on the show. I was actually looking it up.
I figured I'd just
throw that out there. But you were in episodes 120, 166, 196, 216, and 223. Oh, and then now this one. So 228, I think it'll be. You're a legend.
Yeah.
My God.
Legend.
What kind of person records 228 episodes of the podcast? Like, get a life, Chris.
Yeah, I don't know. My questionable decisions are like my most often like workout time on Strava is between 8 and 10 p.m. on like weekdays, which, yeah, that's kind of a weird thing to do also.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, well, yeah, I don't know.
Like, and I don't,
we started the whole podcast about you looking for a boyfriend. So 8 to 10 p.m. sounds just about right. So anyways, amazing. Congrats. I think it's just phenomenal. I mean, I already mentioned the time of that one, but for those that don't know, Megan also has the second fastest time and is the only female to ever do the cumulative three mountain races and has completed that in 18 days, 12 hours, 36 minutes, which is like, wow. So I don't know if a better word for that. I'm not a writer, but yeah.
You know what I think is impressive, or maybe speaks to how challenging the mountain races are? Like, you know, it's 18 days and change. The total distance is, I think, like 2,700 kilometers. Is that right? 37? Oh, gosh, I don't even know.
So 19 is the biggest one, and then, yeah, maybe 3,700 makes sense.
Maybe 37. So it's less distance than the divide, but like it took me like 3 days longer. And I just think that like kind of emphasizes how challenging these events are. There's a lot more hiking, there's a lot more pushing your bike, more trail and technical terrain, and you know, the altitude, longer distances between resupply, more exposure, bigger swings in temperature, although the divide is quite a bit of that. So I think that I feel like I've been recalibrated after this season. And when I ride around here on like normal Forest Service roads, I'm just like, oh, this is a cinch. Like I can rip around in my Warbird on like 44 millimeter tires, and it just like, it feels good and easy because it is compared to the terrain I've been on this year. Those rough Soviet roads.
And
the
I think also, though, like
you
mentioned about the distance not being that much less than the Tour Divide, but the elevation gain across the three is insane compared to like the Tour Divide itself.
That's true. Yeah. The Tour Divide is like, you know, it's mountainous, but it's, I feel like Nelson's races are intentionally like hilly, where it'll just send you up something because he wants to, versus the Tour of a Divide kind of just like zigzags the mountains that happen to be there. So yeah,
what inspired the goal of, you know, taking on these three mountain races, and I know they're adding a fourth next year, so is there a way you can do that fourth one and it'll just tie in with these three, or you have to do them all over again?
I think you'd have to do them all over again to have the, you know, the prestige of doing them all in one season. And there have been other women who've done them all, but not in one season. So I know Hannah Simon did Atlas and Silk Road last year. And this summer, or this May, she did Hellenic. So she's also a Triple Crown finisher.
That's cool.
And I think maybe Quinda has done all three. I think there's a few women, but not in one year. Yeah, I guess.
Is there something on in the background of your house? Is it a garage
door? Yeah, my dad's opening the garage and closing it.
Okay, I was going to say, it sounds like a garage door opening and closing. I thought it was mine at first.
Yeah, we can, if you want to edit this out, I can.
That's okay. I'm sure he'll stop opening and closing it eventually.
Yeah, maybe.
So you were saying, you're definitely not the only woman to have raced all three of them. It's just, you're the first to have done
that's
in
right.
1 year.
Yeah, that's right. The motivation was like coming off the Tour Divide and wanting to do something even bigger. And there's not that many races bigger than the Tour Divide. And there are in different ways. Like if I wanted to do the Iditarod, that would be a huge, big challenge for me, right? Or going back to the TCR, that would also be like a pretty epic thing to sign up for. But yeah, the mountain race series just kind of spoke to me. I love being in the mountains. I loved how they're on three different continents and very different terrain and cultures and people and adventures. And I guess I was excited about having a big season, doing three big races, taking a big swing in a single year. And I was also turning 40 this year. So you can view it as a birthday present to myself or the start of a midlife crisis. Up to you. But yeah, that kind of prompted me. And I also knew that if I said I was doing something like the mountain race series, I'd probably be able to get a little bit more sponsorship money than I have in the past, which has been zero. So I was able to get some sponsorship money this year, which was pretty awesome, because I could not afford to swing this big with my own like part-time job and stuff.
Yeah, I think that was definitely like a game changer for you. I wanted to ask though, before we, maybe we'll dive into that a little bit later, but how did the three races like test different aspects of your endurance and mindset? I know we kind of talked about it before in a sense when we had talked about the two races, but you know, how were they different on you in terms of endurance and mindset?
So the first one was Atlas, and it's early season, so coming out of the Canadian winter, I had a shoulder injury going into it, and then my lower back was acting up, I think because I had a new bike and maybe the fit wasn't so good, and I hadn't been training properly in January. So it was just a huge, like it was like from sofa to ultra race.
From sofa to 4,000 meters or whatever.
Yeah. So I was in a lot of pain, so that tested my mindset. In like, how much pain can you tolerate and still want to continue moving forward? And I didn't think about scratching, but I was like pretty uncomfortable for long periods of time, and I would not want to be in that much pain again in a race. Like I that was my first thought when finishing, was like, wow, I don't want to have that experience again.
Okay.
And it took me a long time before I could like stand up straight and like move properly. I had some bad chafing. So like, you know, that shower you take after you have
everything kind of burns.
Yeah. And I didn't even have a shower. I had a big bathtub with one of those, like, I don't know, telephone shower handles. And it was very uncomfortable and unsatisfying. And I was like, I just want to experience pleasure and joy, and everything hurts.
You're like,
But I,
call
they did give
concierge
me
and be
a
like, do you
house
guys have
robe.
Epsom salts? Like a bucket. I need
Yeah,
a
so
bucket.
I don't know, man. The salt might have killed me.
That's true.
So yeah, so getting through the pain was like, I feel like my story in Atlas, but the scenery was so spectacular, and that's what really motivated me. And I am motivated by seeing new, beautiful, interesting places. And it was just like a Dr. Seuss book or a trip to another planet. It was so strange and awesome, and the people were really friendly. So, you know, when you're kind of getting into your own head and some stranger says hi to you, you know, you just feel a little bit better, and that kept me going. I think Hellenic tested me in terms of mountain bike skills, which I had been working on before the race, and it I guess I lost my sleeping pad. I didn't bring a sleeping bag, so I had an emergency bivvy, and I slept outside most of the time. So it maybe tested me in choosing smart sleeping spaces, and like, you know, trying to have good qualities of sleep even when I wasn't quite prepared for it. And I think I mostly succeeded. I one night that was a bit crappy. It was cold and windy and just a bit too exposed, and there was a bus shelter down the street that I should have slept at. But yeah, that was, I think, the terrain combined with needing to be really careful about where I slept was what kept me going, or kept me like on my toes. But it was like it felt like and a race I entered with more of a beginner mindset, because it was more mountain bikey, and that's not my expertise. And knowing that gives you the freedom to make mistakes and, like, you know, just kind of not care if you're not moving as fast, because it's like, I'm not supposed to be a good mountain biker. I never said I was. So when I saw myself rising to the front, it was like even more exciting and unexpected. So I think, like, when people ask me which race I like the best, I had the most fun in Hellenic. Yeah, but Silk Road is legendary, and it's the most memorable and the most challenging and just like the biggest and the wildest. And like, I think it was the most profound experience, and like most of it was enjoyable, but like I feel like to me Hellenic was just fun. Yeah, I think Silk Road was an event like of extremes. Everything was it was just like huge, and you're so tiny in this crazy like wild landscape, and so much of it is above 3,000 meters, so it's very exposed, and you just feel really, really far out there. And all the races are quite remote, but Silk Road even more so. And I think, you know, feeling that satisfaction of moving through a place that's so remote on your own, and getting to experience these, like, you know, historic Silk Road trade routes that people have been, yeah, visiting for, you know,
Thousands
like
of years.
thousands of years, but they don't see a ton of people nowadays. You know, there's shepherds and there's some tourists and other bikepackers and hikers, but they're very like special places. There's no trash. There's very few structures besides yurts. It just feels like a place where it's got a lot of history. And sometimes you see like random bits of barbed wire and broken vodka bottles, but not a lot of not a lot of sign of human habitation, which was kind of cool, you know, to be in a place where, for instance, that 30K hike a bike up this valley. It's basically a goat trail slash
30
river bed
kilometers
for
hike
some
a
of
bike.
it. Yeah, it was actually longer because I had to hike down, because I'm not technically skilled enough to bike down steep trails. So it was probably 35 for me. But the downhill is a walk in the park after hiking up, I guess. So, but that section is just a really interesting way to link up. I think the kind of south and the east, or the south and the north of the country, and it's a trail used by shepherds to bring the animals up and down through the summer grazing pasture. But there's, you know, there's no one in the middle. There's, you know, some yurts on the one side and some on the other, but in the middle it's just like this goat trail through
So,
a pristine valley.
how long does that take? 30 kilometer hike a bike. I mean, is it like close to a day? Like, 'cause it feels like it must be really slow.
Yeah, Nelson told us to. Oh, there's the garage.
Hey, Dad.
Nelson told us to think about it being a day or more. And I think I hit it at like around 8 a.m. And I got to the summit at like 6 p.m. I hoped to get to the summit at 5. So I was an hour behind my schedule, which I don't know how I made that schedule. It's just what I
just decided. Arbitrary numbers.
And then I was able to get, you know, complete the descent and get onto like a flatter, like less, I mean, like a proper road before it got dark.
Yeah, I get it. Was it just push, or did you have like a system of like a strap or something, or a way of like connecting yourself to the bike to hike?
I was just pushing. It's hard to say if having like a backpack or something for it would have been better, or a strap, because I feel like it's a lot of strain to put that much weight on your body. Come on, Dad. Like, I don't know what he's doing. Just leave the door open or closed. Yeah, I feel like there's some strain in attaching it to your body. I haven't used a backpack or a strap or anything like that, so I don't actually know. And there's some really steep grades where you're, you know, carrying it on your back, and I found it better to carry on my back for the water crossings. But the trail is really narrow, so you have to decide, do I want to be on the trail, right, or should the bike be on the trail? And and it's mostly not too steep. It kind of goes from around 3,000 to 4,000 meters over 30K, so not like a crazy grade, but there are parts that are like quite steep, and you know, there's these big rocks, and it's a bit of a Tetris jigsaw puzzle to like get through everything. Kind of, I felt like I was rock climbing sometimes, because you have to analyze stuff before you do it. And one of the lessons that I learned from this race in particular is that, like, just because there's a route doesn't mean it's always safe. Like, there's no guarantee. You have to make assessments based on your own fatigue and the conditions and all of these things. And I think before I would have thought, you know, if there's a route on Ride with GPS or a race director gives me a route, I'm just going to assume that it's like fine for me to ride. And like, that is definitely not the case with this race. Right. And you have to know yourself really well. And and that can be hard, like hitting sections at night.
And you're lucky you hit that hike a bike in the daytime, because like I imagine if it'd been nighttime, you'd just lose motivation fast, because you'd be like, every step it's just the same thing. There's no change. There's no scenery. Like, only where your light shines. It's got to be mentally exhausting.
Yeah, and a lot of people ended up doing parts of it at night, and you know, if you sleep up there, it's pretty cold, because you're going to be above 3,000 meters and close to running water, which is always colder. I'm definitely glad that I hit it when I did, so that was a smart move. There was a sneaky hike a bike in the last section of the course after CP3 that I hit in the evening after the bog walk, and did that all at night. It was about 15K, and it was pretty rough, and I wasn't expecting it, so my expectations were, to kind of get to the high point of the summit and then come down to the next town and be able to sleep low. And I didn't get anywhere near the summit. I ended up spending like, you know, 4 hours on this hike a bike that I imagined doing in an hour if I was riding my bike. So that was really hard to wrap my head around. I have a dynamo, so the light isn't so good when you're hiking. And I had a headlamp, but my headlamp, I picked a smaller, more packable one that isn't as bright. I think I have an outbound one that's very bright, because I just didn't feel like I had the space for it. But I think that was a mistake. I should have made space for it somehow, because it's so great to have that brilliant headlamp.
And those outbound lights, they're warranted for anything. Like, if you would have just tumbled down the mountain, like in the Atlas, and it broke, you'd be good.
Yeah. I hear they have a good warranty.
Yeah, so I saw their post of like somebody's dog chewing it, or somebody took it apart. And I'm like, who would take a light like that apart? But I mean, somebody would.
Somebody would.
Yeah. Let's talk about your bike. I know that you had some, obviously not second thoughts, but frustrations when it came to the first of the races, because the bike arrived in the new year and it's so soon upon race time. And, you know, it took a while to get it set up. And like, I think you flew to Morocco without the fork installed, and, you know, so many of these little things. But tell us more about your bike and how things came together over the three races, because I think you slowly got everything dialed in.
Totally. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. I got a salsa cutthroat carbon with the like electronic shifting axis transmission or whatever, and it was awesome to have a new bike, but I made some modifications for it for the mountain race series because it was going to be rough terrain. So I swapped in a 120 millimeter travel suspension mm-hmm. fork, and I used that for all three races. And then I added the grip things to the handlebars for Atlas to kind of give myself a little more like hand space.
It's like the inside, added, the inside bars or the.
No, I added the Redshift
top grips.
Yeah. For the Atlas Mountain race to give my hands a little extra like cushion and stuff. And then for the Hellenic Mountain race, I went to flat bars. So I took those off and I got the inner bar end grips, the mm-hmm. SQ Labs ones, which I thought were really nice. They make you feel more like you've got a road bike grip, which I am used to and more familiar with. So I honestly don't think I could have done a flat bar race, like ultra, without those grips, the SQ Lab grips.
Do you use aero bars on all these races or none, or how did that work?
I used aero bars for Atlas, and I didn't use them much in Atlas until the last day, which was all in a headwind and quite flat, and like a little bit here and there, but not as much as I hoped to. I think because my lower back hurts so much, it was not a comfortable position for me. So that kind of dictated my decisions. In general, I'd recommend aero bars for Atlas. And then Hellenic, I took them off because it's all up and down. It's got like the same elevation as Silk Road in like less than half the distance.
Right.
So there's not really a point in having aero bars. I added the Redshift suspension seat post, the shock stop suspension seat post for Hellenic. And that made the descents a little bit more, to help down the descents. Mm-hmm. And I used it for Silk Road as well. And the washboard in Kyrgyzstan's pretty rough, so it was really nice to like protect my saddle area. So yeah, I guess going from Hellenic to Silk Road, wasn't in love with the flat bars, so I went back to drop bars, and I kept the suspension seat post, and I put aero bars back on. I kept the same wheels,
top grips, same again light. as in the first race.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I use the same wheel set, like bicycle, custom gravel, like wide gravel wheels with dynamo front wheel with a K-light, which I think is a really nice thing to have for all these races because they're quite remote. Maybe not as necessary for Hellenic because it's so mm-hmm. steep, and it just feels like you don't have as much charging time because when you're going up, you're not really charging much, and the down is so fast. So it might not have been necessary for Hellenic, but for Atlas and Silk Road, like, so great to have a dynamo and be able to charge my electronics mostly.
Even if you're going to, like, for others, if they were going to just not have, like, the K-light, but have a normal light, you have the charging power just to run stuff in the background, right? Like, you don't necessarily, even if you don't have the dynamo light, which can be quite expensive, it's a good option just to charge, I guess, right?
Yeah, just stay on top of your charging because there's not a lot of charging opportunities in Kyrgyzstan, a few more in Atlas, but, you know, if you are getting services in the middle of nowhere, it's going to be a yurt and there's probably not going to be a power plug-in. So you might be able to get some hot tea and something to eat and a warm place to sleep and maybe some water, but you're not going to be able to charge there. So being able to kind of take care of your charging a bit more, it felt really good. And for Silk Road, I actually experiment with slightly fewer battery packs. I usually bring like at least like 20,000 milliamp hours or whatever. And I guess I went with 18 instead of 20,000, but it felt good to kind of go smaller because they're heavy, right?
Yeah,
and I always believe in bringing two battery packs because, like, you know, the dynamo could break or mm-hmm. the cables could get wonky, or you could break a charging block or something like that, or you could lose one or it could jump out of your bag. So Ron Denier Cycling taught me a lot about redundancy. Yeah. And I always
like having two power banks because I feel like two 10,000s, well, you can plug in both in at the same time to charge, as opposed to a 20, which is one big thing plugged in that just takes forever. And like you said, if one of the 10,000s breaks, well, you got the backup. But if you're 20,000 and you only have one of those breaks, you're kind of pooched.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. But I did feel like I got a lot more comfortable on my bike over the course of the season. I was able to make those little changes so that I, you know, wasn't riding in unnecessary pain. I think my body felt really good in Hellenic and Silk Road. Like I maybe popped like a couple ibuprofen throughout the course of the race, but I didn't have the pain that I did in Alice. It was mostly just the fatigue and deep fatigue, and the impacts of altitude for me were just that it was harder to breathe, and I felt like I wasn't wearing a power meter, but I'm sure I was pushing like 100 watts on those climbs and it felt like 300.
Okay. I was going to ask about that because I know it is that generally a lot of the races at a much higher elevation, and it's got to be pretty tough because, like you said, I think you get up to about 4,000 meters, or what's the high on that?
Yeah, you get around 4,000 meters several times. A lot of it's over 3,000. Checkpoint 3 is down at like 1,400 or something, and you descend from like 4,000 to 1,400. And then it was awesome, but I got cold because it's so much descending. And then you immediately start climbing out. So, you feel like, oh, this is how it's supposed to feel when I breathe air and it comes in my lungs and I feel good afterwards. And as soon as you leave the checkpoint, you know, you've got like 10K along the beach and then you're back up climbing again.
And you know that's coming. So you're like, oh, already in your mind, you're going downhill and you're like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Now, you are sponsored by Renee Harris, and you are using the Fleecer Ridge 2.2-inch tires, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
How did those work out? I've never used them, but I love the size for, like a drop bar mountain bike or my mountain bike in general. It's just over that 2-inch gives you so much more traction. How do they hold up for you, and what are your thoughts?
Yeah, they held up well. I swapped to a new pair after each race, and now I have like 3 sets of tires with lots of life left on them still. But I always believe in changing your rubber before a race, right? So I was a little less confident in Atlas because I was riding a new rig with a new fork, and the tires I had been riding around the Okanagan in the winter on like flat trails, so I hadn't had experience like descending on them or cornering at speed, so it took a little time just to become confident on a new tire, and once I did, it felt it felt really good, and now they feel second nature to me because they've been what I've been running all season long. I think that they held up really well in the rocky terrain, and all of the events have some pretty pretty sharp rocks and rough stuff. And I think it's not, some of it is the tire, and the sidewall, and I have the endurance casing and there's an extra light extra endurance. So I'm kind of in like, I don't know, the endurance casing, it's not as supple, but it isn't as prone to, it doesn't slice as easily.
And
as
the last thing you want on an event like that is to have a change of tire or have a serious gash, like sitting there with a sewing kit that you probably don't have trying to sew up a tire.
Right. Yeah. So nothing like that. I had a small puncture in Hellenic that I was able to plug up very quickly, which is the ideal situation. And I rode on that tire for a while. I just changed it out before I left for Kyrgyzstan. And then, no other issues. Everything kind of running smoothly, and I'm feeling good on the descents and stuff. I think I picked my line like pretty carefully, and that's a skill I've learned. I used to get a ton of flats road cycling. Whenever I went through like a construction zone, I would just end up like nailing something.
Every nail stuck in your tire.
Oh my gosh. And I just think I wasn't looking, because I'm like, well, the road's supposed to be smooth. And as soon as it got a little rough, I would get tons of flats. And I got better at riding on unconventional road surfaces. I think in the 2022, the summer I did TCR, and I took my road bike over stuff that summer that road bikes should not go on, and I didn't get any punctures. So I think that to me is proof that I have improved my cycling skill set.
I've used the Mezcals, but I like, and they're good, they're fast, but I also feel like they don't have that grip. The ridges down the middle are pretty close together. There's not a...
Okay.
I feel like the grip is always an issue if I'm on serious stuff. So I was wondering about those Fleecer ridges. And I think it's a little bit more of like little, the nubs are a little bit more spaced, so you kind of get that traction, maybe?
Yeah, the nubs are like the same spacing all over the tire, so there's not like a speed strip down the middle or anything like that. So they seem to grip pretty well. They're what I'm planning on using for future events. Like, and now that I've been riding them for a year, they, like I said, they just feel like what I've always ridden.
Yeah, second nature. Any gear decisions you would like, that you would rethink in hindsight? Particularly with Silk Road. Yeah, especially after, I guess, pre-race touring.
Pre-race touring, I brought a tent and I decided to race with a bivvy, and I don't think that was a mistake. Mm. The weather can be iffy. You can get storms, but they usually blow in the late afternoon or early evening. And I was hoping that I would be kind of through any bad weather and being able to, you know, sleep in someplace dry. And that was the case. Uh-huh. I did have like way more sleep kit than I have ever had before. Okay. I had a whole front roll with a sleeping bag and a sleeping mat, like a blow up Nemo Tensor Four Season, and then I had the OR Helium bivvy, and it all just took up like a lot of room, and I don't know a way around that. My sleeping bag was rated to -8, and you didn't necessarily need one rated that low because, you know,
you have a puffy jacket too, right, and some things.
That's right, yeah. But I felt really cozy, and the temperatures got down to -6 on at least two occasions, okay, according to my Wahoo. So, like, being able to sleep in those colder temperatures, and I am, like, I run cold at night, I get pretty chilly, and I was, you know, going directly from, like, creek crossings into my bivvy bag. So you're wet from, like, the mid-calf down, and now you put on your wool socks and you have to go to bed and be warm. I was glad that I had the warmer sleeping bag overall, but I just wish it was smaller. But you got to make these choices about your kit, and if I had a smaller sleeping bag, I don't think I would have slept as well. The night before I left, I was packing up my bike to do the bike check, actually, with Cameron Russell, who, like, filmed the little bike check video for Apidura with me. Okay. And I had to get my bike ready to, like, do the bike check video, and I hadn't actually loaded it up fully. I had gone on a shakeout ride with a friend, but I forgot a bunch of stuff. So I didn't, like, bring my battery charger, for instance, for my electronic shifting batteries, and just random stuff I'd forgotten to bring. So when I went to put it all on my bike, I couldn't fit it all in my bags, and I was, like, having a little meltdown.
Oh, no.
And, you know, my mom was trying to help me, but kind of getting in the way, and I could not get my sleeping bag into the 3-liter stuff sack that I wanted to put it in, because it comes with like a 10-liter stuff sack or something, and there was no way that was going to work. And she ran across the street and asked one of our family friends, Sandy, if she could do an emergency alteration to my sleeping bag, and she cut like a foot off the end to make it small enough to fit in a 3-liter stuff sack.
Oh, that's too funny.
And it was, yeah. And she was so amazing. She was like, lying on the ground, getting the bag, and she measured it. And she was like, now, are you sure you want me to, like, tear apart this sleeping bag you've never used?
Expensive.
And I was like, yes. Get on it. Tear it open. But yeah, I was grateful. It wasn't too short. You know, they're made for like regular sized people or regular sized men. And I'm 5'6". So I figured she could cut a bit off of it. And I was still nice and cozy.
Yeah. Ideally, you'd buy like the short version, or like women's sleeping bags, I think, are coming in slightly shorter, right? Typically.
Yes, I think you're right. And this one had like a long version or a regular version. And I just went for the regular version. And it was the Rab Mythic Ultra 360, well, in case anybody bags. Is wondering.
Poor thing. That just,
yeah, it was a sweet bag.
I'd like to take a moment to thank a couple more sponsors of the Bikepack Adventures podcast. Redshift Sports was founded in 2013 by a team of mechanical engineers who also happen to be avid cyclists. From the beginning, they focused on taking a different approach to product development, drawing on their own experiences and needs to create components that make a meaningful difference to the riding experience. The highly popular ShockStop suspension system smooths out road imperfections, reducing fatigue and strain. You can check them out at redshiftsports.com or follow the affiliate link down in the show notes to help sustain the podcast. Use the promo code BPA15 to save 15% at checkout. Tailfin Cycling, designer of technical bikepacking equipment, has been creating waves in the cycling community for several years, having stepped outside the conventional boundaries of bikepacking equipment to find unique solutions that make the adventure all the better. Whether an endurance racer, bike tourer, or bikepacker, these bags offer solutions for everyone. From their unique rear rack with quick release mechanism to their ingenious locking mechanism on their panniers that provide a rattle-free biking experience, Tailfin continues to push the envelope. I'm extremely pleased to have them supporting the podcast and to represent them on all my adventures.
I can't think of too many gear changes I'd like
That's
to make.
Awesome, though.
I think
but
next
I mean,
year
I agree. I was gonna say I agree with you. Like I'm known. Like I do this continuously, but I will suffer through terrible sleeping nights because I will underpack, and you're not rested, and then the next day is kind of just utter hell. And at some point, I would always end up getting a hotel when I was like doing this big trip out west because I would just like this tiredness would build up. Where if I had just maybe a slightly heavier sleeping bag that was a little bit warmer, I wouldn't be freezing all night and I would be like cozy.
Yep. Well, that's my lesson for you and your listeners.
Yep.
Upgrade that bag.
And then get some scissors and cut it up.
Yeah,
and I guess you changed your tires before the Silk Road, but then you did some pre-touring, but I mean nothing serious enough that you would choose that. Oh, I wanted to ask, what did you decide in the end regarding spare tubes and stuff? Because I know we talked about it last episode and you were trying to decide, oh, how many tubes do I bring? Do I bring like the TPUs or the silicone or?
Yeah. So I went with two rubber tubes and then one of the TPUs. I probably would have brought two, except I couldn't find the other one. I have found it now because they're so small. And yeah, it's Kyrgyzstan, it's so remote, and because I have like deeper rims, I can't just like buy a tube off the shelf. I realized unless it has the valve core that gets removed, and that's not always the case in cheaper tubes. So I just really wanted to have a backup. And you're thinking about the stakes, like it's not just the Silk Road. If I DNF because I get too many flats, it's the mountain race series that I'm giving up. So I think thinking about it as a series forced me to maybe make a few more conservative decisions because you want to get to the finish line. I did tour like 1,000 kilometers before the race. So, ideally, like I probably would have started with a fresh chain and a fresh, fresh set of tires, but that didn't seem feasible. The chain would have been feasible. I just didn't think about it.
Yeah.
But the tires, like it's hard to change tubeless tires in a place without a bike shop.
I mean, I think like 3,000 kilometers on a chain is not bad so long as it's taken care of. If it's kind of, during that 1,000 kilometers, you kept it fairly clean. You like oiled it regularly and whatnot.
I just broke the chain on my indoor trainer bike, which is my old TT bike. Oh. And I probably changed the chain about 3 years ago when I did Silver State 508. And it was making kind of grindy noises. And like mid-workout, it just snapped, like not at the quick link. And I felt very powerful. Like I was pumping out the watts on those like VO2 intervals. So I got to change. I got to put another chain on that today. Instead That's of awesome. Dealing with it, I just put my road bike on.
Fair enough. Tell us about the water crossings. I know there were a lot of them, and you're going to get wet. So how do you handle that? And I guess, was that low? Was it high? How cold were you after, because it's mountain water. So, give us the deets.
Yeah. Most of the water crossings were pretty chilly. Previously in my life as a bike packer, I haven't actually done that many water crossings because I live in a pretty dry area. Mm-hmm. There's been a few dry years, so there hasn't been a lot of water in most events where I've done crossings. And even on the Tour Divide, there weren't that many water crossings. There was like snow, but the water wasn't deep. In the past, my strategy has been to kind of remove my shoes and socks and try and keep those dry. Because of the number of water crossings, that was not feasible. You just had to leave them on unless you wanted to, spend all of your time taking your shoes and socks on and off. But it just didn't seem feasible, especially with the 30K hike a bike. There's probably like 50 water crossings. And at the end, you're just kind of walking up the low creek bed towards the summit. So I initially carried my bike and kind of just like lifted it up. And on one of the earlier ones, the water caught one of the wheels and knocked the bike into me, and I fell into the water and all of my electronics got wet. No. And yeah, and everything dried out and it was okay. But my phone around the same time turned off and I couldn't get it turned back on again. And I thought it was damaged from the water, but I didn't know. And it did turn back on. It's just like a glitchy old phone. Okay. It's been giving me trouble for a while. So I'll definitely upgrade it before the race season starts next year. But I was like, you know, kind of a bit freaked out. And that was on my way to checkpoint one. And so I've been up for, you know, I've been on the bike for 20 hours at that point. I was not feeling great, kind of climbing up to 3,800 meters for the checkpoint and then worrying about my phone and my electronics and just being like, you're a hot mess and this event's hardly started, Megan. Like, you better get down the mountain and get some sleep. Things cannot continue like this. You're going to have like your stuff spread out in the rivers all over the country. So after that, I started taking the water crossings a little more, I guess seriously. And I would take the bike and flip it on my back. It felt like I had more maneuverability when it was up there.
Like upside down on your back or just a...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's some great photos of me carrying it. And like a little, one of the reels has me like demonstrating my technique from the media team. But it like was a pain to get up there. And I'm glad that I've been doing so much off the bike training at the gym and stuff to build up the upper body to, you know, be able to flip it there. Because at the beginning of the season, I definitely like I couldn't lift a 5-pound weight with my left arm, let alone like put a bike up
there.
Yeah,
that's right.
So yeah, it felt really good to be strong and fit and able to do that. And then when the crossings looked like they were going to be really deep or they were murky, I would leave the bike. I would take off most of the clothes I was wearing and just wear like my shorts and jersey so that if I fell in, my warm clothes wouldn't be wet. Mm. And I would like walk the crossing to like make sure I had a good path and there was no like pits or anything I was going to fall into, and then walk back and then put on my clothes and a, you know, waterproof bag, and then put the bike on my back and then walk over and then put the clothes back on and ride away. And that process like took a little bit longer, but I think was necessary for safety. And you're like out there very much alone and by yourself. And one of the the race director allowed us to receive help from other riders during the river crossings or in the river crossings.
Oh, okay.
You know, for safety. Yeah. So, you know, we could have worked together. Two people could carry one bike, or, you know, I could ask someone to carry my bike if I felt like it was just impossible for me, or if there was locals around, I could ask them to help me. So the river crossings were kind of this like neutral zone or something like that. And they're also higher later in the day than earlier. And it was kind of said in the pre-brief, like if you get to a water crossing and it's doesn't look safe, then don't cross it. Like, you have to wait until the morning. Like, it's up to you to make these decisions. And
luckily you know, you had that's a pack part of the event.
Right. But people definitely, like, I saw some of the dots a few times and they got stuck on one side of the water crossing, not feeling like it was safe, and waiting it out until the morning. And that's the right decision, but it's a weird thing to think of, and it feels unfair in some ways, but I think it's just part of the race, and everybody knows the water crossings are part of this race, and you have to have your strategy. And, you know, my strategy evolved quite a bit from kind of dragging it through and taking my shoes off to just, you know, getting it on my back and trudging through. But yeah, it's part of the race. Everybody
Did you ever have
that.
Any sketchy calls where you felt like a little unstable and like things could go south?
Like I fell three times in total. That first time where the bike kind of fell on me, and it was a wide like crossing without, it was kind of a like sandy or pebbly, so the surface wasn't bad. Another time I fell at night and I had just lifted up the bike, but there's big stones and boulders and my foot slipped and I smashed my knees and my glasses fell off my neck where I had them kind of clipped there. So I lost my clear glasses and I hit my knee pretty hard. And, you know, when I realized my glasses were missing, I went back into the river and looked for them and couldn't find them. Somebody found them somewhere. So maybe I didn't drop them in the water, and I picked them up again at the lost and found at the finish. So I was pretty happy to be reunited with my like $200 glasses. So but when I wrapped up for the night and I climbed into my bivy and I took my rain pants off that I was wearing, I just had like like blood everywhere my knee. And it was kind of like, oh, wow, you really did hurt yourself, Megan. But then you forgot about it. And, you know, yeah.
Soldiered on.
Was a bit of a wake up call. Soldiered on, as you do. Yeah. So those were the two kind of rougher experiences I had. Yeah. I think one more time I stumbled a little bit. I was okay. But just the knowledge that there's no one to save. Ah, my leg's cramping. Oh, God. Sorry, I'm sitting cross-legged.
It's
on
hard
the floor
work to sit out of chair.
Is a training
hey?
Room. I'm not out of the chair. I'm on the ground.
Okay.
I don't have a clear space or a private space. So, yeah, too many bikes. Which shouldn't be a problem anybody has, but that's what I have. And I won't keep them in the garage because sometimes there's break-ins in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah?
And I can't lose them.
That hasn't been an issue here in Chelsea, but yeah, it definitely would be an issue in Ottawa, you know?
Yeah.
What about your gear? I know your packing kit, your packing setup. You mentioned the handlebar roll, or was it the handlebar roll, or was it the like Apodera AeroBar bag?
Yeah, it was the roll. So the bigger one. It was a bit. It was stuffful, and I kind of couldn't get a bigger one because of the drop bars, right?
Yeah.
And I also like kind of believe in using the smallest packs you can on your bike. Mm-hmm. So it had worked for me other times where my sleep setup wasn't quite so robust, and it still did work for me, but I kind of wished for flat bars a few times just to, because the bag was close to the bars unless I really like shoved everything in there. Yeah. And again, I think I just had a bigger sleep setup than I anticipated. Maybe I needed to cut another foot off that sleeping bag.
I think the fortunate thing though is with the electronic shifting, you're not like toggling a lever. So the lever is not getting impacted,
true.
Right? So it's just a,
yeah.
If you had have had mechanical and you have to push that lever way over, there'd probably be like, be touching the bag, and then you'd cause yourself
That's
some
a good point.
Injuries in your hand. Cause I've done that and it sucks. Like,
yeah, no, I didn't experience that. Yeah. And I think, I can't tell if it would have been better to do flat bars for this race. Like, I don't love flat bars, but a lot of the terrain was pretty technical and more technical than I imagined. So, like, I think that they weren't a bad choice. Everybody else on the podium, male or female, in the top three, they all had flat bars. I was the only one running drops. So, yeah.
And so what other bags? You had a, I'm assuming, like a long top tube bag, frame bag.
Yeah, long top tube bag, full frame bag for my water, and a down tube bag with most of my tools and stuff in it. I had two stem packs, and that's where I kind of stored all my snacks.
Is that the new square pack there, that one? Or?
Yeah, new little like rectangles. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I feel like you can put a bit more food in them. I think they're 1.2 or 1.3 liters.
Okay.
And there's a magnetic closure, so they stay dry and they're easy to flip open. I had a seat post bag and then the small packable backpack from Apodera, which expands to like 13 liters, I think. So there was a few times like for that long hike a bike, and then there was a 400K stretch with no resupply that probably took me 48 hours to do. I was able to just pack up and be kind of like indiscriminate with what I was buying and throw it in there. So I had like loaves of bread and like cans of tuna and just things that would fuel me without having to think about how small they would be. There was a few times where I love chips. So I buy bags of chips.
Too.
And they take up a ton of room, so being able to carry that in my backpack.
Do you like crack them open, get the air out?
Nope, I just throw them straight in.
Throw them straight in.
Because, yeah, I know some people crack them, let the air out,
them.
And they get all crinkled. Pre-crush them so they're nice and small. Yeah. And they have these sandwiches in the convenience stores, and they're like pre-made sandwiches, and they're kind of, you know, wrapped in a cellophane bag or whatever, and they've got writing on them, but of course I can't read the writing. I'm sure I could use my Google lens or whatever.
Is
the
writing in Russian or in Kyrgyz, or is it like a...
Oh, I can't even tell you. Yeah. Not in English. So it was always kind of like a sandwich surprise. There was one that was a Donair one,
so
which maybe sounds a little sketchy. Yeah, it was always a surprise, and I never got sick from them. And it was nice to have like real food when you know you're riding all day and you're not getting hot food except at the checkpoints. So,
yeah, I don't know how many times I've been in Japan. And I go to the corner store and I'm like looking at some of the, you know, the rice triangle of things, and I'm like, that looks like it could be meat, but it could also be natto, which is like this Japanese bean thingy that's fermented. And I'm
okay,
it's just the magic. Magic rice roll thing. I don't know. It is what it is.
Surprise roll.
So let's talk, you know, what were some of the other defining features of the route? I know crazy hike of bikes, lots of river crossings. Anything that stands out that you'd like to tell us about?
I think just like huge mountain passes.
Yeah.
Like much bigger than events I've done before. And, you know, the Tour Divide, it's just up and down over passes, but they're not this big. So I think we started around like 1400 meters in Osh, the second largest city, mm-hmm. and immediately went into this climb up to almost 4000 meters. And it was my second largest climb on Strava after Haleakala in Maui, which is 0 to 3000.
Right.
So it's a pretty big thing to dive into. And the first, you know, it's like a little bit of climb out of Osh and then some rolling gravel roads. And then, you know, you start climbing a bit, but then it really kicks up. And you're just in the mountains going through the LA mountains. And the final part of the climb was hike a bike. And that's actually where I found my groove. It was like just before dawn. And I was like feeling really alive and energized and stoked to be out there. And I was mostly by myself, you know, kind of seeing riders once in a while.
Was the sun peeking up and it was just that, or is it still dark?
It's still pretty dark. Okay. And kind of like as I came over the summit, the sky was lightening and you could see more, not lightning, but like, you know, more light or more daylight.
Lightening.
Lightening. And when I got over the summit, the descent is awesome. It's not as steep as the climb up, so it's this very long descent, so you can just kind of like, you know, sit back and enjoy it. And the sun was coming over like these jagged rocky peaks, and you're descending into kind of this grazing land in the valley. And and it was pretty wicked. The media car was there on the descent somewhere, and I just like looped a couple times and ripped by them. I wasn't ready to stop and talk, and I felt really, really good. And the first couple nights weren't as cold. I think I don't know how the temperature patterns work in the country, but there are some areas that are just colder than others. So it's not just altitude that makes it cold. I think some regions are colder than other places, maybe closer to where there's glaciers. Like I haven't looked at a map that closely, but the first couple nights weren't that cold, which was kind of nice. And then later on, it got real. So the big climbs were a part of what I think, made this event part of the characteristic of this event. And there's also a lot of awesome valleys and rivers you're just kind of riding through these valleys for long periods of time with the river next to you. And sometimes there's water crossings, sometimes there's just these little bridges. Whenever I hear water now, I'm like, oh, I hope there's water I hope there's a bridge. Like I get like I start freaking out that I'm going to have to cross the water without a bridge.
We call that PTSD.
The bridges were so sketchy. Oh, it'll pass, I hope. the people were really friendly, as well as the people were really friendly, and the, you know, the shepherds all have their flocks and herds. So just like lots of horses and sheep and goats and cows, and the animals to me felt very docile. Like I am afraid of horses, and the horses in Central Asia I think are just like a different breed than our scaredy cat North American horses. They were so mellow and so chill. I never once startled a horse, and like I've had so many negative encounters with horse people, and I try and do my best, but the horses are all so skittish. I had someone yell at me because I ripped down the road the other day and they were walking their horse on the sidewalk, and I guess I scared it and I didn't announce I was passing because I was on the road. And
they got mad at you.
Yeah, that was earlier this year. But so anyways, I don't like encounters with horses, I worried about that here, and I didn't have any, so that was good.
I've done some horse riding in Mongolia, and those Mongolian horses were kind of small, but they were like super like chill. Like, you know, you can see all these big Westerners climbing onto them, and they just didn't care. They're just
accepted their fate. We can learn something from the horses of the horses of other parts of the world.
Yeah. I guess also, like, what was your sleep strategy? Did you try to mostly sleep at night, or was it kind of like if I'm tired, I'm going to sleep? Or how did that work?
For the first night, I kind of said, if I'm tired, I'll sleep. And that went through like the first maybe 24 hours, because I hoped to push through. And that was my strategy to kind of start out with a solid push. But also knowing that, like, you know, I'm 40 now, my body has its limitations. Like, if I need to sleep, I need to sleep. So I wanted to kind of give myself the grace to take a nap if I needed to. And not
the
just
air
keep,
might
like,
play
trudging on.
And the air, like oxygen, whatever levels might make that necessary too. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And when I was touring, I took like lots of naps. So I wondered if it would be like that racing, but I don't think I really napped when I was racing. Okay. So yeah, I tried to sleep at night. I tried to be off the bike 10, 11 o'clock. And my strategy initially was to sleep for like 4 hours or 4 or 5. And I ended up sleeping more like 5, 5.5. And I also... I knew that I wasn't going to sleep indoors that much, but I only slept indoors twice and I was out there for like 9 days. So yeah. I got less indoor sleep than I imagined, which I think speaks to why, like the importance of having a good outdoor sleep setup just because I ended up outdoors so much. And I think there were probably opportunities to sleep inside that I maybe didn't see. Like there was a shipping container that a bunch of people slept in and I literally slept like 50 feet away outside because I don't know who checks a shipping container to see if it's unlocked. Exactly. I don't. Like, it's a weird thing to do. But once Robin, the race leader, slept in it, I think people got wind that it was an option. And there was just like a bikepacker party every night in the shipping container afterwards. And then some of the yurt camps, you could stay there, you know, could ask, you're not allowed to like ask to stay somewhere. That's like seeking help. But you could say like, oh, do you know if there's like accommodation around, and they might say, oh yeah, you can sleep with us.
Okay, or, so that's, you know, how it works. If they offer it, then it's okay, but if you ask, that's not allowed. And I guess that's just comes down to like sportsmanship and stuff to not be the person that's asking, pretending it was offered or something.
Yeah. And I know some people were camping in areas close to yurts and, you know, the folks would be like, what are you doing outside? Come stay with us. And that to me is just like the most beautiful thing. But on the other hand, I don't like sleeping near other people. I like my space and my privacy and I like to make snoring sounds alone and I don't just like to hear other people's snoring sounds. And, you know, so I don't think those options would have been great for me, even if they had come up, which they didn't, just because I like, I value my privacy too much. And on the other hand, I thought I would be able to make a few pushes to like get to different checkpoints to sleep or get to different towns. And because the terrain is just so unknowable, you know, you look on a map and you just can kind of get a sense that it might take you a while, but unless you're really going to dig down into those ride with GPS tracks, like you don't actually know how long something's going to take until you get there. And yeah, of course it's slower to climb, but you know, if you're walking, it's slower still. So I wished I slept indoors a little bit more, but I'm glad that I was okay outside.
I always find that when I'm indoors though, I end up like everything becomes longer. Like I find it maybe because I'm paying, I have this sense that like, oh, maybe I'll spend a little bit more time or like, you know, and I wake up a little later, I'm a little slower getting going, where if I'm outside, I'm like, all right, let's rock and roll, you know?
For sure.
Yeah.
But those moments of like having to take off my sleeping shorts and put on my like cycling shorts and like -6 outside the bivvy, that was terrible. You do it fast, but they're pretty terrible.
All the farmers, the herders, like, ah, it's so light.
It's dark. You don't see anyone.
Any moments, I mean, either hike or bikes, of course, and maybe falling in water, but that were mentally tough, aside from the whole race.
Yeah, those moments for sure. On the surprise hike a bike, there was a section where I like got off the trail and it was kind of like, I think it was called the Tranquil Valley Trail or something. So it was near a river, but there's all these streams coming into the river. So every time a stream comes in, it does like a little doodly-doo. And so it's not like, it's not a straight, smooth trail. And there was kind of, like a little bit of a, I don't know what, like ravine, I guess. And the trail crossed on the high side and I didn't see where it crossed. And I thought it looked safer kind of on the low side. So I tried to walk down and none of it looked very safe. But I was like, well, this must be where it's at. And I can't like put my bike down and examine, you know, I can't just tromp around on foot here. Like I would have to walk back to put my bike someplace right. safe. And I slipped and fell into the ravine and the bike fell on top of me. Oh, and then rocks were like tumbling on top of us because it was pretty like a lot of scree. And I was just like, oh, my derailleur's up. And like we were all fine in yeah. the end. But I didn't know my bike was fine until maybe 20 minutes later or, you know, until I could kind of hop on and try and ride again because I was on an unrideable part. Right. And it just felt, yeah, it felt pretty scary. And again, it reminds you that you're very much out there by yourself. There's, you know, there's probably somebody about an hour behind me and an hour ahead of me. But if I needed help in that moment, like I could call for help and no one's going to come.
That's right.
So yeah. I'm just stuck there. And it was hard to kind of scramble out of the ravine once I was in it. And, you know, again, just not feeling like super motivated to like continue on this hike a bike in the middle of the night, but knowing that there's no other options. And it's, yeah, so you just kind of like carry on with it. But I definitely tried to be more careful after that point and like, you know, really assessing the trail ahead of me and just, yeah, making sure that I was like, you know, I was like super zoomed in on my, my Wahoo to make sure that I was as close to the track as possible. So yeah, that part was mentally tough.
And you're so close to the end too. So it's not the time you want to make a mistake. That's like,
exactly. Yeah.
I know. I think this year was a new route, right? There was some changes to the, from the previous routes. I think they added maybe all this hike and bike. I don't know.
For sure. Yeah. Every route changes every year. The route changes.
Oh, does
so
it
it's
every
not
year?
A static route.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, historically Atlas and Hellenic have been quite similar from year to year. I feel like there might be some switch ups with Atlas next year, but the route doesn't change that much. Like there are changes, so you can't compare, like, it's not like it's straightforward, like, you know, route that you could ITT and compare it to the last year right. or whatever. But I think there's more variation in Silk Road because there's more roads that are like amazing and beautiful
these
and
old Soviet
to
roads
explore.
And tracks, I guess. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many options. And I think like Nelson kind of, I don't know, I guess I don't want to take his words from him, but I feel like he kind of wants to showcase all that Kyrgyzstan has to offer cyclists. And that means changing the route up and showing people different areas. And this year, I feel like there was like 600 or 800 kilometers of new to the race terrain, which is a lot of new terrain. I think previously it's been a few hundred kilometers, even yeah. though the start and the finish location have changed several times. So there was a lot of new terrain that he'd recce'd out, but had not been in previous race routes. And there's, yeah, and there was parts that had been included before, like around Nerin and the Arabel Plateau and the Borhan Valley. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of neat to be places that you know that other racers have done. So, you know, you have this like shared experience with people throughout the years.
Some shared level of suffering.
Really, yeah. Yeah. And it was really exciting to go to those new places and, you know that like I was kind of in the top 10 the whole time and I am one of the top 10 people to be riding this new course. Like it just was exciting.
That's very cool. Yeah, actually, I met somebody recently who was like, oh, do you know who Nelson, what's his last name?
Trees.
Trees, right? Yeah. He's like, do you know who Nelson Trees is? I was like, yeah, well, everybody kind of knows him. He's like, yeah, I went to university with him in Montreal. I was like, that is so random. Like, I was like, that's insane.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't even know the guy studied in Canada, you know?
No, I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So apparently. You are now a sponsored rider, you know, with some supportive companies and stuff. How has that changed things for you, you know, made your life so much better, I guess, or stressed?
Yeah, it's opened up a lot of doors. I think the stress that I feel is, it's probably some internal stress more than like stress from sponsors to like do well, because I want to be a competitive force and I have kind of like, I kind of pitch myself as a, you know, a competitor, and that's why I'm there, to compete. Okay. I'm not there to like stop and smell the roses and like have a wonderful experience. Like that's why I tour, but also, you know, finding joy in the competitive aspect of the sport, I guess. And I think competition can bring out great parts in us that we didn't know was there. And I think that's part of what I'd like to, you know, share. But at the same time, if I don't do well, then I am going to feel bad, like, you know, about over delivering on my promises, even though I never promised anything, like in terms of results. I just wanted to be the first woman. I just wanted to be the first woman to ever do all three mountain races in a single season.
Oh, yeah, no big deal.
So, yeah. But yeah, I know it's really opened up doors to me, and it's cool to, like, I remember when I finished the Trans Am, or when I did the Trans Am in 2017, like, I saw everybody was using, not everybody, but a lot of people were using Apidura bags on their bikes. And I was living in Saskatoon, and, you know, there weren't many bikepacking bags for sale in the local bike shops even. Like, I don't know how I picked mine out, maybe just because they were the ones available. But I remember seeing all this Apidura kit and being like, oh, wow, like, what is that brand? Everything looks so nice. Like, and I asked somebody, he's like, you've never heard of Apidura? And I was like, oh, no, I don't think that exists where I live.
I live in Saskatoon.
And to be sponsored by them now, and, like, you know, yeah, it's really exciting to kind of transition here. But it's also, like, been a journey. Like, my first race was in 2017, and I've been touring since 2009, so I feel like I have been really working up to this point. Like, nothing's happened overnight, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like everything's kind of happened gradually over time, and I don't know what to say.
Most of the relationships you have, are they kind of organically grown, or is it like they reached out to you, or was it like, because, you know, you were riding Salsa and you were using Apidura, and these kind of relationships just bloomed from there?
Every time a brand reaches out to me, I just assume it's a bot and a scam. So that doesn't happen very often.
You mean I should be deleting all those emails?
Yeah, no, I just assume it's a scam, because I don't think brands reach out to riders very often, unless they do, just not me. But a few have. And again, I've been like, I don't know. Is this a real human? Like,
right.
Maybe I'm just super skeptical. I'm not sure. I think most of the cases I've reached out to people, and I think it's good if you have some sort of connection to a company, or like, you know, maybe like a distributor through the bike shop that sponsors you, and you can get them to pass on your athlete profile or something like that. Because I feel like there's probably a lot of people pitching themselves to different brands, and to be able to get your achievements into the hands of the right person, and maybe have someone kind of vouch for you, right? And be like, oh, okay, you know, this rider is sponsored by a shop that, you know, I supply to or whatever, and they speak really well of her, and she's really crushing it, and I think would be a good ambassador for you. So take a look. So I think something like that is probably ideal. And I haven't pitched many brands in the past like year or two, just because the responses are like so difficult to get, and it takes a lot of energy to,
yeah, it does.
I guess maybe it doesn't, you could just have a pitch deck and send it out, but I like to personalize things. And I think the energy of pitching and maintaining sponsorships is a lot to like, you have to account for that on top of training and the logistics of competing. And if I don't like have a connection with somebody, I'm pretty hesitant to like ask them to support me. I just feel they'll be like, who are you? And I'm at the point where I guess, like, it's always nice to get free stuff, but what I really like is more financial support. And I don't think...
And that's the hardest thing to get.
Yeah. And I don't think I can just, like, ask somebody to give me money. I kind of have to build that relationship. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know how long, much longer I'm going to be doing this. Like, is it worth my time to start building new relationships? Like, but then I'm like, Megan, like, it's never too late to begin a relationship with something. Like, you never know what could happen. Don't be a pessimist.
SRAM, if you're listening, she has been using the electronic group.
God, I would die. I would love to be sponsored by SRAM, because,
So any companies that hear this, make sure in your note you say, this is not a bot. Megan, I listen to the podcast. Please read.
Yeah. No, but it's been really exciting to just to have other people believe in me and my passion. And ultra cycling is such a weird, random niche thing, right? The fact that like anybody pays attention to it at all outside of our sphere and bubble, which I think is maybe growing. A lot of people like bikepack racing, but or bikepacking and bikepacking recreationally and dipping their toes into racing, or I don't know. It's so hard to,
This ties into my next question too, but you know, as you've grown as a household name, is that the word to use? in the bikepacking world. When you're probably doing that, the TCR, it's like mom in the background messaging you, go Megan, I'm cheering for you. But now it's like, there's so many people sending messages and support. And how does that feel? And, you know, does it distract you at all when you're in an event, you know, with Instagram and messages popping up on whatever, and, you know?
Yeah, I don't look at my Instagram messages during events because it's too much of a distraction. Yeah. And I have someone else kind of handling my socials and filtering stuff to me that
you just delete the app off your screen for the meantime?
Or? No, I just don't. I look at the messages, but I don't feel obligated to. So I don't check all of them and I don't really respond to much. So if you get a message from me during a race, you are very special.
I'm going to test that theory next time.
Yeah. I have a lot of... I have a handful of people in like a group chat, so I send updates there and I'll look at those messages sometimes, and it's just nice to have everything mm-hmm. in one thread. It keeps kind of things organized, and then you get the daily updates from, I think, like a lot of the tracking websites, like Track Leaders and Follow My Challenge, to them, where people can message the website and then you know, it gets passed on to you and you get a little like daily summary. So I often check those when I'm eating, and it's always cool to see where people are coming from. Right. They'll be like, go Megan, go, coming from Florida, cheering you on. So I do enjoy the messages, and it definitely kind of reminds you that like it's a sport and people are watching. This is like an NBA game or something for people who are interested. And it reminds me that, you know, I'm here to compete and I'm here to do my best and not linger too long at the checkpoints. And, I'm here to get down to business. I guess it excites me that people are entertained by what I'm mm-hmm. doing and following along and finding that balance where it's not a distraction, but I know that I need some like contact with the outside world. When I did TCR, I was like very self-isolated. I didn't talk to anyone on the phone and I kind of like didn't check my messages and just went a little bit cuckoo, and I don't want to do that again. So I think a little bit of contact for me is good.
Yeah, it's like cabin fever, but not in a cabin. Now that you've completed the mountain race series, you know, what might come next? You know, any plans to return to any of these races or writing projects in the works, things we should watch out for?
I definitely plan to be writing some more in the fall. I'm dog sitting in the Kootenays for 7 weeks or 6 weeks. I'm not sure. Some time. And I'm hoping I can really dive into the project I was working on last fall, which was about my 2024 Tour Divide. I've got a few kind of recaps and write-ups about the mountain race series and Silk Road in particular for some of my sponsors. So I'm really excited to share those stories and get them out kind of like sooner on their websites and stuff. So that's what I'm doing like right this moment. Once I've kind of ticked those off, I'm going to move into kind of thinking about my big project, which was writing about the Tour Divide. And I am going to start training again for my 2026 races pretty soon. I've been joking that it's like my Rumspringer. Like I just kind of, I'm out in the world and I'm doing what I like, and soon I'm going to have to come back and settle into my routine that I know and love. But haven't been so focused lately. I've done some more hiking and laid back stuff. Next year I am hoping to return to the Tour Divide, actually. I feel like it deserves another shot for me.
I was gonna ask, like, what's the plan next year, if you have thought of it, decided on it? Tour Divide
and Taurus Mountain Race, the newest addition to the Mountain Race series.
Oh, you're going to go do it. Nice. Yeah, you have to, right? Like,
have to. Just have to.
When is that one?
I think October.
Oh, it's in October. Okay.
Yeah, and it's in Turkey. So Tour Divide, second Friday in June, and this one's in mid-October.
So that'll be the two big A races. And
that's right. Yeah. Definitely like to pad out with some smaller events, but trying to stay local, a little bit more close to home, because I feel like traveling takes a lot out of me. I'm not the most organized person, and logistically I've had a hard time like preparing and leaving and coming back, and I haven't like fully unpacked from coming back from Silk Road yet, and I've been away like three weekends since. So I've got like piles of things I need to deal with, and like I need to deal with. This is becoming a disaster.
And I know we talked about it before, and it was just one of those really cool things, is that you have taken the time to like go to the locations early, do some touring, get a feel for the country, the people, And that's a pretty special thing not everybody has the opportunity to do, because a lot of people are using their entire year's leave to just go do this one event kind of thing, right? So,
yeah, for sure. I feel super lucky that I've been able to spend more time away and get a feel for a place and not just, you know, race through it and have regrets about that potentially. Like, I never felt bad about racing because I knew that I had time before and after mm-hmm. to experience the place more fully. So, but yeah, I'm hoping for most of the year a bit closer to home next year. There's so much cool cycling in the Okanagan and the Pacific Northwest. And there's a new event, a further event in, I think, the Chilcotin, sponsored by Seven Mesh. So okay. I'm going to do that in September. It seems like a kind of a shorter race. I was going to say a gravel race, but I don't think so. It's going to be probably pretty rough if it's in the Chilcotins. And yeah, I'm hoping to do that and then see what else appears on my calendar.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Anything I missed that you wanted to chat about?
No, I feel like I've talked about a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Time yeah. flies.
If you are thinking about bikepacking in Kyrgyzstan, I would like fully recommend it. It's a pain in the ass to get there, but like, from North America. But once you're there, it's
what was
an
your
amazing
flight
country routine to travel. Yeah, so I drove to Vancouver and spent a night there with some family friends, drove to the airport in Richmond, flew to San Francisco, and then had a short layover and then to Dubai, which was the okay. big flight. It was like 14 hours or something. My bike didn't make it past San Francisco.
Of course
and
not.
Then I flew from Dubai to Bishkek, and then the bike followed me to Dubai, and then I got to Bishkek like 48 hours later. So I it was like almost a week in travel with
oh,
the time
wow.
zones, because you lose time
and
then
the bike,
with
waiting
the
for
bike
bikes
being
and stuff.
Delayed. Yeah.
And then to Osh, did you bike to Osh or did you take a bus or
I
something?
I did.
You did?
I toured the Celestial Divide, so I biked the whole way. So that was a really cool way to get there. And it just felt... It feels so good leaving like a big city on a bike. Like I rode out of Marrakesh, I rode out of Athens, I rode out of Bishkek this year. And each time you just feel like you're, I don't know. It just feels cool to be yeah. in traffic and knowing that I'm going to sleep in my tent or my bivvy in like the mountains tonight. And how cool is that to see that transition happen right before your eyes and go from, you know, your home country to a city
yeah,
to
yeah.
like the wilderness. It's awesome.
If you're like at a traffic light and some bus is pumping out black smoke and you're like, I'm going to be away from this real soon. Thank God.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's very cool.
So, yeah, really long.
But I guess like on the same note, like you said, like touring something like Kyrgyzstan is amazing, but not to be taken lightly and, you know, be prepared for any kind of circumstance that could come up, right? Like make sure you always take care of you first and don't take stupid chances.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. There's a few routes up on bikepacking.com to choose from, which makes it a little bit easier. You have some POIs and some people's like reflections and, you know, folks you could potentially reach out to and a bit of a community around bikepacking there, which is really cool. And I would also say bring a stove. I didn't for touring or racing, and I didn't need one racing, but touring would have been really nice to have a stove
right.
Because you just kind of, you're not eating as well. I brought some instant mashed potatoes from home and would add like toppings to those, but it was pretty sad eats and
like you just add some water and stir it in and it's
eats.
Like cold
yeah
that's
yeah.
pretty gross. Is that the Idahoan
no,
potatoes
actually...
those are pretty good.
Yeah, I think they're the Idahoan. Yeah. I had like different flavors and I had these bags that were like 800 calories, so I would have half for lunch and half for dinner. I think I bought three and then I would like yeah just shake like chips, or they have these little like I forget what they're called. Starts with a C or a K, but these little like circular kind of calcium milk balls that are super salty, but I thought were great garnishes.
Oh,
and bring a stove like a normal person. It's probably hard to buy fuel there, but I think you can get it in Bishkek.
Especially
so, yeah,
like a multi-fuel stove or a like a Trangia.
Oh, yeah,
or
that would
something.
Be smart.
Yeah. Awesome.
Go ride your little heart out. It's beautiful. The mountains are calling.
I so want to go there. All right. Well, I will say thanks for tuning into this episode of the Bikepack Adventures podcast. Megan Hakkinen continues to redefine what's possible in ultra-endurance racing, and her journey through the mountain race series, culminating in a first-place finish at the Silk Road Mountain Race, is nothing short of legendary. From gear choices to mental grit, Megan's story reminds us that adventure isn't just about the miles. It's about the mindset, the community, and the landscapes that shape us along the way. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out Megan's previous appearances on the podcast and follow her on going adventures through her writing and social media. You'll find the links in the show notes. And as always, if you love the show, please take a moment to rate, review, and share it with your fellow bikepackers. Your support helps keep these stories rolling. Until next time, keep on pedaling. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks, Chris. That was fun.
Talk soon. Bye-bye.
Talk soon.
I want to end the show by thanking all my listeners once again for the emails and comments I regularly receive from you. It really helps motivate me and keep me going with this project and to continue sharing people's amazing stories. If you have any comments or questions, you can email me at chris@bikepackadventures.ca or go to bikepackadventures.ca and shoot me a message through the contact form. You can also check out the webpage for past podcast episodes, bikepacking routes throughout Canada, blog posts, videos, and touring tips. Lastly, I'd like to once again thank all the individuals and companies that are supporting the podcast. Head over to bikepackadventures.ca/partners for some amazing deals. If you're enjoying the show and would like to become a supporting member, head over to www.patreon.com/bikepackadventures to sign up. Patreons get to enjoy early access and ad-free podcast episodes. You can also support the show by sending a one-time donation through PayPal. This money all goes back into the podcast, helping me to cover the costs associated with running the show, buy new equipment when necessary, and continue to produce the high-quality content that you've become accustomed to. Much appreciated, and keep on pedaling.